From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Mr. President, my name is Juan Raúl Garza. First of all, I want to thank you for the reprieve and giving me this opportunity to file for clemency.
Juan Raúl Garza is set to die tomorrow. He will become the second federal prisoner to be put to death in a week. Swedish police shoot three people with live ammunition as protests against the European Union continue. President Bush calls for NATO to expand to Russia's borders as U.S. firms scramble for oil in the Caspian Sea. We'll look at U.S. interests there. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Slovenia. Police arrested more than 20 people this weekend after a scuffle at the U.S. Embassy and beat Italian activists trying to enter the country to join protests during the meeting of the U.S. and Russian presidents. Later, riot police faced off against nearly 1,000 anti-globalization protesters who had marched to the Russian embassy Saturday afternoon. Police brought in armored cars and a water cannon, but a woman planted herself in front of the convoy. Protests by groups opposed to American and Russian policies took place as President Bush and President Vladimir Putin met in a 16th century manor north of the Slovenian capital. Shortly before the two presidents arrived separately at the airport, 22 members of the environmental group Greenpeace were arrested after five of them jumped the fence at the U.S. embassy. Two of the protesters chained themselves to the stairs leading into the embassy building. Another tried to climb the flagpole and remove the U.S. flag before he was apprehended and handcuffed by embassy guards wearing civilian clothes. Outside the compound, the other activists chained themselves together and held up a banner reading, "Stop Star Wars." Also on Saturday, Slovene authorities stopped a bus carrying about 40 members of Italian-based anti-globalization group Jabasta after it crossed the Italian side of the border. The police spokesperson said Slovene border guards ordered the bus to return to Italy. When several of the activists tried to leave the bus to protest the order, Slovene guards pounded them with nightsticks to force them back inside. This, according to a filmed report broadcast by Slovene television. Meanwhile, Amnesty International collected signatures in the Slovene capital for petitions against capital punishment in the United States and Russia. The organization had planned to send its petitions by fax to Brdo Castle, where the American and Russian leaders were meeting. However, after sending 30 copies, someone disconnected the line. Meanwhile, the European Union met behind double fences of metal cable in Gothenburg, Sweden, as 25,000 people marched in the streets outside. 243 people were detained on Thursday alone when President Bush met with European Union leaders. On Saturday, police fired live ammunition into the crowd, injuring three people. One person, who was shot in the abdomen, is in critical condition in the hospital. We're joined right now on the telephone by Orjaman Beristam, who was there. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
You're a member of the head council of the Gothenburg Action 2001 for a Different Europe. Can you describe what happened? How did three protesters get shot?
It started with a peaceful Reclaim the City manifestation where people were dancing to music and having fun, totally peaceful. But still, the police decided to confront the demonstrators, and the result of that was quite heavy riots. Demonstrators throwing stones at the police throwing stones at the demonstrators, and in the ending, one policeman fired his gun right in the crowd, hurting three people. And the big problem is that the policeman didn't shoot any warning shot. He didn't scream, stop or I will shoot. He just in cool blood raised his gun and shot three people. It was about 35 or 30 meters away from the policeman, so I don't believe that it was a necessary action from the police.
Is this unusual for the Swedish police to shoot protesters?
Yeah, it's quite unusual. But we have seen a tendency to more police violence here in Sweden in the last years.
What is the reaction right now in Sweden?
In Sweden, there's a terrible reaction. The media, in much, seem to think that the police did right shooting demonstrators. And it's a very big problem here in Sweden because they legitimize police brutality in a very disastrous way. We hope that with this, they will change this process and we'll start to look at the police reactions and understand that the police has had a terrible line in confronting the demonstrations here in Gothenburg.
Who were the three people who were shot and who's the one who is critically wounded?
Yeah, the one who's critically wounded is a local boy here, 19 years old. He's from Gothenburg. Another guy who's also Swede. Who was shot in the leg, and I believe that the third person is a Frenchman, also shot in the leg.
And why were you all protesting?
Of course, there was an EU summit, and a lot of people is very critic to the politics of the European Union. So we were protesting against the neoliberal politics and the European Monetary Union and against the Schengen Treaty and against the militarization of the Union. Sweden has a long and strong tradition of do not have any military connection with other countries, and now we are entering a... The Sweden government is a part of building a European United Army, and many people believe that that's a terrible way.
And your message to President Bush, and do you think he heard it?
We hope he heard it. It was a quite big demonstration against his presence, too. And in Sweden, he's not very popular, also as a person and as a representative for the politics of the United States.
Why not? What issues?
Here, very much people are upset against Bush breaking the Kyoto Treaty. And they're also... they're also very much against his killing people with a death threat, death sentences and such things. And also, of course, his neoliberal politics in the United States with lesser rights for workers and less social welfare and so on. Just the kind of politics we are protesting when they occur here in Sweden and in the European Union.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Örjan Bergström, member of the head council of the Gothenburg Action 2001 for a Different Europe, speaking to us from Sweden, where three protesters were shot by police during President Bush's visit and after. And finally, more than 30 protesters broke into a U.S. Navy range in an attempt to block the resumption of the bombing of Vieques, saying 2 years is too long to wait for an end to the bombing. Navy jets from the USS Theodore Roosevelt aircraft carrier were to begin dropping bombs as early as this morning. Meanwhile, the Bush administration will ask Congress to cancel a referendum on the Navy's use of Vieques as a bombing range.
Cancer spreading ever westward. They're coming to knock down a whole gun store. We will say to anyone who'll listen, relocation nevermore. So won't you come to Big Mountain? Bring everything you can, but come today. This is the land where we belong, and this is the land where we will stay. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? what would you do? If they were coming for you, what would you do?
David Rovix from his CD Live at Club Passim, Song for Big Mountain. As we talk about resources today, President Bush wrapped up his first European visit this weekend by meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Slovenia. As expected, Putin reaffirmed his firm opposition to both Bush's missile defense plan and his goal of expanding NATO to Russia's borders. But media coverage of the Bush-Putin meeting ignored one of the most important disputes between the U.S. and Russia, that over the oil resources of the Caspian Sea region, which holds the greatest untapped oil reserves in the world. The Russian prime minister recently announced that Russia, over strenuous U.S. opposition, will begin operating a major oil pipeline from the region as early as August. Azerbaijan, which is locked in conflict with neighboring Armenia and borders the Caspian Sea, announced last week that it expects to garner at least $8 billion in foreign oil investments over the next 3 years. U.S. oil corporations are eager for a share of the extraordinary profits from drilling in the Caspian Sea region, and the State Department has lobbied fiercely on their behalf. The Caspian Sea region is one of many places where natural resources are closely tied to internal or regional conflicts. Colombia's state oil firm, Ecopetrol, has announced that foreign oil firms, including the U.S.-based Occidental Petroleum, will continue exploring in several regions of the country where the military has committed mass killings against indigenous people resisting the foreign companies. The relentless quest for energy and resources increasingly drives U.S. foreign policy. It also increasingly is tied to many of the world's wars and conflicts. We turn now to Michael Clare, who teaches world security and peace studies at Hampshire College. He is author of Resource Wars, the New Global Landscape of Global Conflict. Michael, we've talked about the Bush administration as the ascension of the oiligarchy. You have President Bush, a failed Texas oil man, Dick Cheney, former executive with the world's largest oil services corporation, Halliburton, an administration packed with people committed to expanding oil exploration, drilling, and production, like Condoleezza Rice, for example, the national security advisor, who actually has a Chevron oil tanker in Nigeria named for her, the Condoleezza Rice. Can you talk about the politics of oil and how the U.S. demand for ever-increasing amounts of oil is, well, literally fueling these conflicts around the world?
Well, you have to begin with the basic fact that's very clear in the Cheney Energy Report, which is that the United States needs vast, unimaginable vast amounts of oil for its economy to function the way it does and for us to be able to enjoy the lifestyle we've become accustomed to. And they're very clear that we need a lot more of it than we have now and that we can't supply that with U.S. supplies alone. Even with Alaska, we couldn't possibly supply the amount of oil that we need. So increasingly, the United States is becoming dependent on extracting the petroleum resources of the rest of the world. And U.S. policy is to try to diversify those sources so we don't become dependent only on one place, like the Middle East, where all kinds of things could happen. So the essence of the Bush plan is to increase U.S. imports not only from the Middle East, but also from Africa, from Latin America, especially Venezuela, Colombia, and Mexico, and from the Caspian Sea region. So you have a worldwide global push to push American companies into these areas to increase our extraction of petroleum.
Let's talk about the most recent developments around the Caspian Sea. You have a New York Times piece that talks about Bush's involvement with negotiating an agreement between leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan. Here is he attacks Clinton's involvement in various conflicts. And even the Times points out a major reason for Bush's involvement is that peace would speed the development of the Caspian oil fields and the construction of a pipeline to carry the oil from Azerbaijan to the west. The favored route would avoid Russia, where the oil flow would be hostage to political events, but it's nevertheless seen as vulnerable because it passes very near to Armenian-controlled territory.
In a region dominated by Russia and by British and French oil companies, Bush no doubt hopes to increase American influence. Tell us where the Caspian Sea is, what are its oil reserves, what corporations are involved, and where does the U.S. government fit in?
Well, the Caspian Sea is in what used to be the southern part of the Soviet Union. In fact, up until very recently, all but a tiny shoreline on Iran. Iran's northern boundary is the Caspian Sea. Everything else around it was the Soviet Union. So we're talking about a place that was once the enemy, the USSR, and now American companies and increasingly the American military are moving into it. It's like moving into Texas. If we had lost the Cold War, Russia was in Texas taking over the oil fields. You have to picture how they see it. Azerbaijan was part of the former Soviet Union, as was Armenia. So this area is seen as possibly being the second largest source of oil after the Persian Gulf, which remains number one and is unchallenged. But the Caspian could be the second major source. And the United States government is determined that that energy will flow to the West and not through Russia or through Iran, our two enemies or adversaries in the region or challenges. They don't use the word enemy anymore. And they're determined that it comes to the West through Turkey to the Mediterranean. And therefore, because the Caspian doesn't have an outlet to any ocean, it has to go by pipeline. And that means the pipeline has to cross from the Caspian area somehow to the Mediterranean. And the only way to go is through Azerbaijan or Armenia or Georgia and then Turkey. And all of those areas are rife with instability, ethnic conflicts, political disputes, the Kurds in Turkey, and so forth. So here what we see is that President Bush, like President Clinton before him, are very deeply involved in the politics of the Caucasus to work out an arrangement that would allow this pipeline to travel through those countries safely. And that's what this is about.
What are the corporations that are involved and have the most to gain?
Name a big oil company, they're all there. Chevron, Exxon, Texaco, they're all deeply involved. Amoco, now part of British Petroleum. So all of the oil companies see this as a major site for additional oil supplies.
And so how does someone like President Bush broker an agreement that favors U.S. Oil exploitation?
Well, first of all, bear in mind that for the U.S. government, oil is different from all other commodities. It is not just another trade commodity. It is seen as being vital to national security. And this goes back to World War II when Franklin Roosevelt met with the King of Saudi Arabia and arranged for a U.S.-Saudi security relationship that endures to this day. So the U.S. views oil as a national security interest, and therefore the government works with the oil companies in order to ensure that American companies are dominant wherever there's oil in the world. And it's not necessarily aimed at a particular corporation. It's aimed at American companies having a prominent position everywhere.
In the Financial Times of the last few days, there's an article about a conservative being offered the IMF job. A conservative economist aligned with the U.S. administration has been offered the key job of first deputy managing director of the IMF. The person who they're talking about is Ann Kruger, formerly chief economist at the World Bank during the Reagan administration in the 1980s, likely to be the controversial choice among many developing countries. How do institutions like the World Bank and the IMF play into this exploitation of resources, particularly in poorer countries, for the wealthiest?
What they help with is infrastructure. You know, to extract oil is a very expensive, complex undertaking, particularly when you're dealing with poor countries that don't have the necessary infrastructure. So they need loans in order to build the roads, the pipelines, the refineries, the whole, you know, industrial scale apparatus. And supposedly out of participating in this, they'll get some royalties or some small change, you know, left over from the oil company profits. And that's really where the World Bank and the IMF step in to help with these and to help the oil companies with financing these multi-billion-dollar projects. A good example, the World Bank is assisting in building a pipeline from Chad in Africa to through Cameroon to the Atlantic coast. That I do believe it's Exxon is one of the principal companies involved in that.
Right, Exxon and Chevron, the Chad-Cameroon pipeline.
Exactly. And the World Bank is putting up some of the financing, and they did this with the understanding that the Chadian government and the Cameroonians would use the money to enhance the lives of the people in those countries and protect the environment, protect the indigenous people in the forests who will be thrown out of their habitat by this project. And, of course, Chad turned around and took the World Bank money and bought weapons to suppress dissidents and insurgents. So this is the way that the World Bank gets involved.
Michael Clare is a professor of world security and peace studies at Hampshire College. His book is Resource Wars, the New Global Landscape of Global Conflict, and we'll come back with him in a minute, and then we're going to hear the clemency appeal of Juan Raul Garza to President Clinton, who put off his execution. President Bush is set to have him executed tomorrow. We'll talk about his and other death penalty cases. Stay with us. We're talking to Michael Clare. His book is Resource Wars, the New Landscape of Global Conflict. He's the author of a number of books, including Low Intensity Warfare. What about Bush's energy policy, much touted, first comprehensive policy that there would be? How would you analyze it?
The Bush policy needs to be read from cover to cover to really appreciate it. And my sense is that the media read only chapter one, not all eight chapters, because it's chapter eight, the last one you get to, which is the international ramifications. That's truly the most important. But chapter one does talk about Anwar, the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, and nuclear power and building refineries at home. It focuses more on the domestic consequences, and that very justly aroused a lot of concern about drilling in wilderness areas, about building nuclear plants, new oil pipelines and gas pipelines. A lot of people are very worried about those implications. But if you get to the end of the report, what becomes very clear is that to sustain a further expansion of the energy sector in the United States, it can't possibly be done with domestic resources, even if we use all of the oil in Alaska and in Louisiana and wherever they want to go, there's not nearly enough. And these people are determined to perpetually expand the flow of oil to the United States. And that means most of it, two-thirds of our oil in 2020, will come from abroad. And they're determined to make sure that the world's oil flows to the United States. And this has dramatic foreign policy implications. The very first, it means plundering more of the oil of the Western Hemisphere. That's what they say is their first priority, is to increase our imports from the Western Hemisphere that doesn't, you know, supposedly have all the problems of the Middle East. Where do they name? Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela. Venezuela under Chavez, highly nationalistic, Colombia civil war, Mexico a history of anti-American imperialism that right now is not the dominant political factor, but something that could emerge again, oil being seen as the patrimony of the state in Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela. So here I think you see a real risk of American military involvement, covert operations in these places to facilitate the strategy of extracting more of the resources of those countries.
Is Bush that different from Clinton? I mean, you argue in your book he's just expanding the groundwork that was laid down.
I think absolutely there's no question that the blueprint here it was developed by Clinton Gore, because you said earlier, you know, that Bush comes from an oil background, but Al Gore also has a history of that sort. His family very close to Occidental Petroleum, which has interests in Colombia. And he was also involved in these efforts in the Caspian Sea to promote the pipeline. So this is a strategy that goes beyond Bush. It is, and it goes back to FDR, that oil is the number one issue in American foreign policy.
Would you say it's fair to say that it's our way of life that drives this insatiable demand for resources and the resulting wars for them?
You know, I think that you have to travel elsewhere to fully appreciate that question, because in Europe and Japan, they have adopted a policy of investing their transportation funds in railroads, in rapid intercity trains, in public transit, in light rail. You could go anywhere in Europe or Japan efficiently, cleanly, quickly, affordably by train. We have invested a huge amount of money in the interstate highway system. This is the biggest public works project in human history on a scale, you know, nothing else compares with it. And if you look demographically at the consequences, it has rebuilt America. We are now a country of sprawl that stretches from coast to coast along the interstate highway system. And this has enormously benefited real estate interests, housing developers, the oil companies, automobiles, mall builders. That is American civilization, and it depends on one thing: cheap, abundant oil. That is the political premise on which our system now works, is cheap, affordable oil. No president, no politician can call that into question.
I mean, didn't Dick Cheney, the vice president, talk about we're not going to be we're not going to be operating according to conservation principles. We're going to protect our way of life.
Absolutely. And our way of life requires extracting more and more and more of the energy, and the especially oil, of the rest of the world. The oil isn't located here. So we have this fundamental, you know, paradox of consuming more oil than anybody else on a very vast scale and developing our country in a way that makes our dependency ever greater. But we need that, and it comes from areas where there's volatility. And that means, I fear, that our military will increasingly be turning into an oil protection force, protecting the pipelines. I think that's already happening in Colombia. Plan Colombia is as much about oil as it is about drugs. I think it'll happen in the Caspian. We already have 25,000 soldiers permanently in the Persian Gulf, and we have enough equipment there to bring in another 100,000 overnight. So this is what I fear.
Can you talk about some of the other case studies in your book? You look at Papua New Guinea. You also look at Borneo.
Papua New Guinea is very interesting because, and a lot of these stories go back to the colonial era, when the colonial powers divided up the world amongst themselves and assigned a piece here to a piece there. In the colonial era, the island of Bougainville, which is a Polynesian island, really part of the Solomon chain, was given to the League of Nations mandated country for Papua New Guinea. Now, these are two completely separate entities, but Papua New Guinea, PNG, was given control over Bougainville. Bougainville houses what was once the world's largest copper mine, the Panguna copper mine. Rio Tinto Zinc of Australia was the owner. And they created an environmental monstrosity, a pit miles long, a mile wide, a mile deep, poisoned all the rivers of this island, and finally people revolted against it. Throughout the copper company and throughout the PNG government, which got all of its income from royalties from this mine, none of which came back to the people of Bougainville. They revolted, threw out the PNG government. PNG hired Executive Outcomes, the South African mercenary company, to organize an invasion of Papua New Guinea. And this so outraged the military in PNG that they overthrew the prime minister of the time, and now there are negotiations underway. But this is an example of how environmental issues, colonial issues, multinational corporations, and mercenaries all figure. Same in the Congo, in Angola, same pattern.
You also write about Borneo.
Borneo is a very large island which has one of the largest tropical forests in the world. It's divided between Malaysia, which has Sarawak as the part of Borneo that Malaysia claims is Sarawak. You have the Kingdom of Brunei, and most of it is controlled by Indonesia. And Indonesia viewed this area as a vast resource to be exploited for the benefit of the people around Suharto, his cronies. He gave his cronies control of all the lumber in what they call Kalimantan.
The old Suharto, of course, being the old dictator, one of the longest reigning in the world, supported by the U.S. government.
Absolutely. And he was kept in power by the military, and the way he rewarded his loyal generals was by giving them possession or concessions to hundreds of square miles of virgin forest to cut down for linked to multinational companies to extract the timber. But these islands were occupied by indigenous people, the Dayaks, who resisted this. To make all this possible, the Indonesian government, and to reduce political pressures at home in the central islands, Java, exported people, poor people from Java and Madura Island, and resettled them in Borneo. And those were the frontline troops, poor people, really, victims too, to clear the forest and burn down the forest and destroy the habitat of the Dayaks. And now with the Suharto thrown out, the current instability in Indonesia, the Dayaks have staged a rebellion, and they're trying to drive out the what they view as the occupying people, the Madurese and the Javanese, who are Hindu. The Dayak people are traditional religionists or Christians. So it's described as an ethnic battle in the press, but primitive barbarians come out of the jungle with machetes and chop off the heads of these victims. But in fact, they're fighting to reclaim their land from the efforts of the Indonesian government to clear the forest and sell it all to Japan and other countries.
You mention Africa. You cited the Congo. You talk about Angola, Sierra Leone. When you talk about resources like minerals, it suddenly puts an order and a kind of comprehension to, as you were describing, what the media, if they talk about it at all, just talk about tribal and ethnic tension. Can you talk about Sierra Leone and Angola?
Yeah, this is the same pattern, and you're quite right that what we read in the press is these primitive passions coming unleashed. These people are less civilized than us. They're more barbaric, They see tribal differences and they go on the rampage. That's the image you get. But in fact, often there aren't ethnic or tribal differences at stake. What's at stake are different warlords competing for control of vital resources, often in collaboration with mining companies and mercenaries and all kinds of other political interests. In Angola, Jonas Savimbi and UNITA, which was once a U.S.-backed anti-communist force fighting against the MPLA, which was backed by the Soviet Union and Cuba, as you know. Now UNITA is essentially like a gang that extracts the diamonds from Western Angola, sells them on international market, Jonas Savimbi pocketing the hundreds of millions of dollars that's coming from the diamond trade, and his cronies getting a share. And there's enough money in it to hire thugs to protect this enterprise. It's like it's become essentially a criminal enterprise in conjunction, it's been shown, with some of the leading diamond companies in the world. And the same in Sierra Leone, where it's Charles Taylor, the president of Liberia, himself a warlord, working with the RUF in the diamond fields. These are the people who became famous for chopping off the limbs of children. That's not out of racial hatred, that's to terrorize the population from interfering with their criminal enterprise of extracting the diamonds.
It's interesting, there's this new term, conflict diamonds, and you shouldn't buy diamonds from these conflict areas that are funding various armies. We never referred to De Beers diamonds under apartheid as conflict diamonds. You know, where are they getting their wealth, these large corporations, but from off the backs of and through the misery of this oppressed population.
Absolutely. And De Beers has been accused of participating or benefiting in some sense, profiting from the conflict diamonds. They now claim that they've instituted internal procedures to prevent that. I'm not sufficiently, you know, knowledgeable about this industry to say whether that's reliable or not, but they're very aware of the damaging publicity aspects of conflict diamonds, and so they're very worried about boycotts and the like, and so they claim at least that they're doing everything they can to prevent that from occurring.
Would you say that the bombing of Yugoslavia was tied to oil interests or resource interests, possible oil pipeline routes?
I've investigated that, and I'm not convinced that that's the case. I think there were other motives involved in Yugoslavia. I think it had much more to do with stabilizing an area that's considered essential to the United States and to the world capitalist market system, which is Western Europe. The fear that that the Balkans would destabilize Europe as it did before World War I. But I don't think it was directly related to energy.
Michael Clare, what about the anti-globalization protests? What effect do you think they have had on reining in this development, or has it fueled it?
That's an interesting question, and I think historians will ask about this for a long time to come. I don't think the protests themselves had any direct correlation. You know, it's a lot like asking what did the anti-war protests, what was their effect during the Vietnam War? I don't think they directly caused anything. I think what they did is destroyed the sense of invulnerability of the decision makers and also their confidence, you know, their smugness, really, about that what they were doing, of course, was the right thing. Now you have people at the very, you know, high decision-making levels saying, you know, maybe we have to think about this a little bit more, that maybe what we're doing isn't so prudent and sound after all, that maybe there are instabilities here that could threaten everything that we want to do. So I think it's forced them to look a little more closely at the negative consequences of what they're doing and allow more space for shifting policy.
Final comments as you have finished up your book, Resource Wars. You actually wrote this book before the Bush administration came in, and yet, do you think Bush has brought it to a whole new level, or it really is just a logical progression? It doesn't matter whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, as we even switch in the Senate from the Republicans to the Democrats. Does it matter?
In the long term of history, I think what we're seeing is a continuation of what Clinton did. But I think that the Bush people, first of all, have made it much more overt and more aggressive. And I think that's the part about it that people haven't quite grasped. The Cheney Energy Plan is really very aggressive in what it says, for instance, about Venezuela, that, you know, Venezuela is essential. We have to go in there. We have to have access to Venezuelan oil and Mexican and Brazilian oil. And this has, you know, immediate and very troublesome foreign policy implications, because whenever that's happened in the past, it's been accompanied by covert operations, by political activity, and ultimately military activity. None of that is in the Cheney report, but I think it's much more, you know, underway, that there's this sort of acceleration of the plundering or, you know, the grasping for these energy resources that I think will produce resistance and conflict.
Michael Clare, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, Amy, I'm really pleased to have had this opportunity. Thank you.
Michael Clare is author of Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict, author of Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, and a number of other books. He is director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies based in Hampshire College, Amherst, Massachusetts. You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at a number of death penalty cases today that are in the news, Texas Governor Rick Perry yesterday vetoed a bill that would have banned the execution of mentally retarded killers. Perry is a Republican who replaced President George W. Bush as governor of the U.S.'s top death penalty state. He rejected the bill 12 hours before it would have become law with his signature. Attorneys for a federal prisoner scheduled for execution tomorrow are asking President Bush for a reprieve. They argue that Mexican officials would not have sent Juan Raúl Garza back to the U.S. if they'd known he would face execution. The lawyers cite a letter from a Mexican diplomat saying his country was not told Garza faced a capital charge when he was extradited in 1992. He's scheduled to die by lethal injection in Terre Haute tomorrow. Juan Raúl Garza, in his teenage years, worked the fields in Michigan with his parents, who were migrant farmhands, and sold fruit door to door. When he returned to his hometown of Brownsville, Texas, he started a drug smuggling operation, and he was convicted several years ago of killing three people in drug-related murders. Now Garza is scheduled to die tomorrow. He is 44. He is Latino. He's one of 17 people of color among the remaining 19 men on federal death row. Elizabeth Semmel joins us, director of the American Bar Association's Death Penalty Representation Project from Washington, D.C. Can you talk a little more about Juan Raúl Garza's case and its significance?
Mr. Garza's case has significance in a number of respects, and you've just mentioned a few of them. Let me elaborate. When Mr. Garza was returned from Mexico to the United States, he actually had fled to Mexico when he was charged with drug offenses, that is, non-death eligible crimes. And he was essentially deported from Mexico to the United States. But at the time of his deportation, the United States government had already decided to seek the death penalty. It did not advise the Mexican government that it was seeking the death penalty, thus his deportation was almost an informality. And what the Mexican government has said in a letter is, as the United States well knows, it has an extradition treaty with Mexico. Had Mexico been aware that the United States had already decided to seek the death penalty, it would have insisted on formal extradition proceedings, and it would have required assurances from the United States that Mr. Garza would not face the death penalty if he was going to be prosecuted in this country. So that is certainly one compelling issue. And, of course, it comes at an interesting time when Governor Keating of Oklahoma has just granted a stay to Mr. Valdez, who is facing execution in that state. And one of the reasons he was granted the stay is because of the international implications. Mr. Garza's case has international implications for another reason, and that is because the United States is a member of the Organization of American States. The judicial arm of the OAS is something called the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and a complaint was filed on his behalf last year alleging that the circumstances of his penalty trial, at which the government introduced evidence of four murders of which Mr. Garza had never been convicted, much less even charged, was a violation of the American Declaration signed and ratified by the United States. The commission ruled in April that indeed his trial was a violation of the due process provisions of the treaty that the United States has signed, And it urged by letter to the State Department that the only remedy, in fact, it ruled that the only remedy available to the United States was either a commutation of his sentence to life without possibility of parole or a new sentencing trial. That issue is now before the United States Supreme Court, which will probably be deciding that question today, as well as it is part of the clemency claim in front of President Bush.
Justice Antonin Scalia is the person who has jurisdiction.
Well, actually, with respect to this particular issue, it came through the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, so it would go first to Justice Stevens. But it's important to emphasize that in death penalty cases, the entire court will be considering this question, as it will another question it has in front of it with regard to Mr. Garza's case. He is the only individual on federal death row whose jury was not instructed that life without the possibility of parole was the alternative sentence if death was not imposed by the jury. So the court, in fact, has two critical questions it must decide in his case.
What about what President Clinton decided in Juan Raúl Garza's case?
Well, that's another important issue. Actually, what is significant, perhaps, about Garza's case is the number of questions it raises with regard to the administration of the federal death penalty. As you know, last December, President Clinton granted a stay, and he did so because a September report of the Department of Justice revealed glaring racial and geographic disparities in the administration of the federal death penalty. President Clinton said until those questions were answered, the execution should not go forward. He anticipated that the questions would be answered by April and that, therefore, a June execution date could be set. It was very clear immediately after his decision that an April determination, that is, an April resolution of these difficult questions, was not achievable. And indeed, the National Institute of Justice was ordered to commence a study, which essentially Attorney General Ashcroft put on hold when he came into office. And as you know, the new Attorney General, has issued a report which basically takes the same statistical information showing these disparities and comes to the opposite conclusion. Essentially, what Attorney General Ashcroft has done is absolved his deputies, that is, his lawyers, of intentional discrimination in the application of the death penalty, which was never the issue. The question is whether system-wide the death penalty, the federal death penalty, is operating in a racially discriminatory way. The numbers of cases coming into the federal system, that is, over 80% people of color, over 90% people actually sentenced to death, strongly suggests that we have some serious problems in the administration of the federal death penalty.
Well, Elizabeth Semmel, we're going to listen to what Juan Raúl Garza had to say. This was after President Clinton put off his execution, but his request for commutation of that sentence. Again, Juan Raúl Garza is now scheduled to die tomorrow, unless the Supreme Court and ultimately President Bush reverses that decision. This was a video that was made for President Clinton. Juan Raúl Garza from death row in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Mr. President, my name is Juan Raúl Garza. First of all, I want to thank you for the reprieve and giving me this opportunity to file for clemency under the new guidelines. I would have preferred to have talked to you in person, but I don't have that privilege here, so I'm just going to say what I want to say through this video. First thing I want to say is that I accept full responsibility for my actions, for which I was convicted of, and to apologize to you and to the families of the victims. I regret what I've done I'm also shameful. For letting my family down. Because of me, they're suffering some, especially my young children, which are of young age. Juan Raúl Garza, who is 12 years old, and my youngest daughter, Elizabeth Ann Garza, who is 9 years old. And my father, who's of old age, I feel I feel embarrassed for letting him down. This is not what he raised me to be, but I chose the wrong path and I made some big mistakes, which I regret.
Juan Raúl Garza, he is scheduled to die tomorrow by lethal injection. He will be the second federal prisoner in 38 years to be executed. Timothy McVeigh last week was the first. Ultimately, President Bush will make the decision. That video, the audio of which you just heard, was made by Mickey Dickoff, preparing for the Garza petition to President Clinton to commute his sentence. He put the execution off, but now President Bush ultimately decides. In another death penalty case, a Mexican man scheduled for execution in Oklahoma this week was granted a 30-day stay following a personal plea on Saturday from Mexican President Vicente Fox to Oklahoma Governor Frank Keating. A spokesman for the governor said Fox asked Keating to commute the death sentence of Gerardo Valdez, who's 41 years old, to life in prison without parole. He'd been slated to die by lethal injection tomorrow for murder, but Valdez was never advised of his rights as a Mexican national to contact a Mexican consulate after his arrest, as guaranteed by the Vienna Convention. Mark Warren is with us now from Ottawa, Canada. He's a human rights researcher who specializes in foreign nationals and the death penalty. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark Warren.
Amy.
So you have these two cases. We just heard about the case of Juan Raúl Garza, scheduled to die tomorrow, and now the stay of execution because of the direct intervention of the Mexican President Vicente Fox of Gerardo Valdez. Can you talk about the principle here?
Well, as in Mr. Garza's case, there are some very significant issues under international law that have been raised in the case of Mr. Valdez. Most specifically, as you mentioned, the violation of his right to contact the consulate, that right is guaranteed under an international treaty that's been ratified by over 160 countries, including the U.S. And essentially, its purpose is to ensure that foreign citizens who are arrested abroad have all of the means at their disposal to present a fair and reasonable defense. There's very significant evidence in this case that was never presented to the sentencing jury. Evidence so compelling, in fact, that earlier this month, the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board voted 3-1 to recommend that Governor Keating commute this particular death sentence. Saturday's announcement by the governor certainly indicates that he's paying very close attention to this issue, and no doubt new and significant information will be presented to the governor, and certainly it would appear at least that for the very first time, a foreign national's concerns and the concerns of their government over this clear violation of due process is being heard by an executive authority. And it comes at a very significant time. Next week, the International Court of Justice will be ruling in a case brought by Germany against the United States for a similar violation of the Vienna Convention in Arizona a couple of years ago. That ruling will be a binding decision on both parties under international law. And Germany has asked specifically for remedies for that treaty violation. So the case of Mr. Valdez has a very, very strong international dimension. But there's also a very compelling human story here. Quite aside from the treaty violation, the Pardon Board heard significant and compelling evidence that the jury was never allowed to consider, and it was largely on that basis that they recommended commutation. So whether the governor is mindful of the United States' obligations under international treaty law or simply looks at this case on a purely human level, I'm certainly confident that the governor is going to give this very careful consideration, and we're hopeful that he will ultimately decide to follow the board's recommendation and to commute this death sentence.
There's another interesting case, and that involves international law, and that's James Charles Kopp. Now, I believe he's a U.S. citizen, but he's the guy who, it is believed, killed Bernard Schlepian, the doctor who performed abortions upstate New York. Attorney General John Ashcroft had to assure French officials this month that U.S. prosecutors would not seek the death penalty for him if France extradites him.
Yes, and that's standard practice around the world. Among those countries that no longer retain the death penalty, it's routine to obtain satisfactory assurances against death penalty before extraditing any person back to the United States where they might face a capital charge. Many countries do this. No country in Europe would dream of sending someone back on a capital charge without that guarantee. The Canadian Supreme Court recently unanimously ruled that Canada must adopt that policy. Mexico, for example, has had a long-standing policy of not returning people to the United States without a guarantee against a death penalty. In fact, I don't know if Elizabeth Semmel mentioned this, but that too is a significant issue in the Garza case. The Mexican government just recently stated in letter to the U.S. government that they would not have returned Mr. Garza had they known that he would be facing the death penalty without first getting a guarantee. So I think what that extradition issue does is it provides yet another context for the growing isolation of the United States among its friends and allies on the issue of the death penalty. The U.S. is literally the only Western industrialized country that still retains the death penalty, and all of its neighbors and its friends abroad are increasingly distancing themselves from the U.S. on this issue.
Mark Warren, I want to thank you very much for being with us, human rights researcher who specializes in foreign nationals and the death penalty, based in Ottawa, Canada. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. If you'd like to email us, send your mail to mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. And you can write to us by snail mail at Democracy Now! WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 1005. That's Democracy Now! WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 1005. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
I'm Warden Jim Willett in Huntsville, Texas.
Witness to an Execution was produced by Stacey Abramson and Dave Isay. Their website, www.soundportraits.org. With today's execution of Timothy McVeigh, President Bush has presided over 153 executions, 152 as governor of Texas. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Anthony Sloan.